Okay, this is the, I think it's the final sutta class today, isn't it?
Saturday?
So having one on Saturday? Guided meditation on Saturday, it's up to you.
It's up to you.
Well, I would flip a coin, but I don't have any money. So what we'll do, we'll just wait until Saturday morning and then we'll sort of see what people want. Just keep it in the present moment. But anyway, today I was asking what do people like about the sutta class or what they want, and somebody said they would like some deeper part of suttas, especially on the stream winner, the sotapanna. So we go back to the word of the Buddha, and so here we go. Actually, the person who asked this isn't here anyway. Anyway, no, she's already on the stream. But anyway, we'll go through it and see how it goes. But if you think this is too much, don't worry about it, because we'll finish off with a nice guided meditation. So anyway, here we go. Now, we can start here, and it's in the middle of this little document, the Word of the Buddha, which I was translating. And it starts off with something which is a very powerful teaching in the Samyutta Nikaya, because this one little sutta, which I'm about to read out, will generate a whole sect of Buddhism. And you know, to this day, people argue, was this Mahayana, was this Theravada? But it was by the monk Nagarjuna who started the Majjhima part of Mahayana, a middle way. Because all the time, the monks, I think because they had nothing better to do, messing around arguing with people, with each other about the nature of ultimate reality. And so what they were doing was saying, you know, is there something? Does something exist? Or does nothing exist? And so they had the group called Sarvastivada, everything is. And then they had the group of like, nothing exists. And so this monk looked at the early teachings of Buddhism and saw that both were wrong. And there was like a middle way. And this is a sutta which he quoted and became really famous and started a new regeneration of Buddhism. So anyway, that's why it's a powerful teaching. So let's have a look. The two extremes and the middle doctrine. And I make sure I didn't call it middle way, because the middle way is like the path of practice, avoiding the extremes of like asceticism and self-torture and indulgence. So it starts off with asking, Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, right view. In what way is there right view? And the world, Kachana, this is Kachana was the monk who was asking the Buddha. The world, Kachana, mostly depends upon a duality, on a theory of existence and a theory of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of phenomena as it really is, there is no idea of non-existence in the world. And for one who sees the cessation of phenomena as it really is, there is no idea of existence in this world. Now what this means is that you can't say there is nothing, that nothing exists, because you can feel, you can know that you can experience sensations of phenomena. So you know these things arise, but they don't persist. It's almost as soon as one phenomena comes up to your conscious awareness, then that disappears and another one takes its place. One arises and then ceases, and then another arises and then ceases. So it can't say there it is. It's almost like you can't say it persists. It comes and everything goes. So most people are attached to one of these wrong views. But one with right view disengages from such dualistic theories about my soul. You have no perplexity or doubt that what arises, what comes into existence, is only suffering arising, and what ceases is only suffering ceasing. Your knowledge about this is independent of mere belief and acceptance. In this way, there is what right view. And phenomena exist is one extreme, phenomena do not exist is the second extreme. Without veering to either of these extremes, the Buddha teaches the Dharma by the middle, which is this dependent origination. With delusion as a cause, then will arises, and this whole process of something coming into existence, and then when these things disappear, the phenomena disappears. And that phenomena includes you, your experience, your perception, your will, your consciousnesses. So, this is a very brief but very powerful teaching. We always think, is there a soul? Is there not a soul? What there is an arising and passing away. And almost something coming into existence, and then it passes away immediately. So this is the idea of cause and effect. Now, I think, see if I can go to, can you go down to page 25? Imagine verse 72, suppose a fire was burning in front of you. That's the beginning. It should be just about a page below. Suppose a fire. Start, that's the first words of the paragraph. I have it on my page 25. Yeah, but sometimes the numbering gets different. Different machines have different numbers. You got it. So this is the quite well used. It's called the Agi Wacha Gotra Sutta in the Majjhima. This is the it's Wachi Gotra was a wanderer, and it's a simile of the fire. Suppose a fire is burning in front of you. Would you know that a fire was burning in front of you? Yes. If someone asked you what this fire burned in dependence on, how would you answer? You would answer that the fire was burning in dependence on the fuel of grass and sticks. If the fire was extinguished, and the word for extinguished was nibbuto, that is this a grammatical form, a past participle, whose the noun is called nibbana? Would you know the fire had literally nibbana'd? Yes. And then if someone had asked you where that fire went when it was extinguished, did it go to the east, west, north or south? How would you answer? The question makes no sense. The fire burned in dependence on its fuel of grass and sticks. When that was used up, not getting any more fuel, it became extinguished. It didn't go anywhere. So too, where does an enlightened one go after death? The question makes no sense. Now, that was a sutta. And to make it easier to understand, you know, that's what I base, if any of you listen to some of the talks which I give, it's the simile of the flame and the candle. Now, a flame burns on dependence on three things: the wick, the wax, and the heat. When those three things come together, the wax, the wick, and the heat, then it's a flame. Now, when any of those three things, the candle, the wick, or the heat, when any of those three things is exhausted, then the flame goes out. When the wax is all used up, there can be no flame. When the wick is all burnt out, there's no flame. Or when the wind blows away the heat, then there is no flame. You need all those three causes and conditions there to produce the flame. And what happens to the flame when it gets extinguished? If it's been a really good flame, and it's cooked Ajahn Brahm's baked beans in the morning, will, because of its good karma, go to the heaven realm where all flames flicker happily ever after. But if it's burnt your finger or burnt your house, is that flame, because of its bad karma, go to the hell realms where all flames just burn endlessly in terrible heat? The question makes no sense. Where does a flame go once it's extinguished? It just is extinguished. And this was the answer, the meaning of this Agiwachagota, the fire burning in front of you. It's talking about your body and mind. What does it burn dependent upon? And mostly it burns dependent upon the delusion and will. You want to live. You want things, and that is a fuel. It's dependent origination, in brief, which keeps you going. And it's a delusion that you can control. The next thing after delusion in dependent origination is called will. Sometimes they call it sankhara. But what sankhara means, if you translate it sort of obviously, clearly, it means your will. Because of delusion. That's why you will things. Now, I'm going to just go off on one of my tangents to make it easy to understand. Years and years and years before Google, I started talking about driverless cars, especially the driverless bus. And once Google started to make driverless buses, they gave no credit to its first, well, not really, originator, because I had it in a different idea. But I imagined that life is like a bus journey. Okay, that's just pretty sort of ordinary. And as you go in your bus journey of your life, there are times when your bus goes through some beautiful landscape, rolling hills and beautiful waterfalls and sunny skies and forests and mountain peaks. And it's just beautiful scenery. And you ask your bus driver, stop, at least pause to go slowly so you can enjoy the beautiful time you're having. Just like when you are at Jhana Grove, you want time to slow down so you can enjoy every moment of the bliss of having no work to do, being able to sleep whenever you want, having no tension or struggles, and a monk who could entertain you with jokes every evening. Oh, what bliss. But you know what happens? It's already Friday. No, it's already Thursday. A couple of days and it's all over. Ah, it's gone too fast. Has it gone too fast? That's what life is when you're enjoying it. It goes way too fast. So, you get fed up with your bus driver. It always goes really fast, you know, when it's beautiful territory. And then, sometimes it's like your bus goes through the toxic waste dumps of life. Just like it goes through industrial waste dumps. And you look through the windows and it's disgusting, it's offensive, it's just rid a lot of suffering. And what do? You ask your bus driver, get out of here fast, put your foot on the pedals and speed out of here. And what happens? The bus driver stops. So you have to experience suffering and pain and disappointment way too longer than you should. And you think, it's that stupid bus driver. The will doesn't know how to get out of difficulties quickly. Oh, you know, you're sitting here and you're restless all over the place. Why do you do that, Mari? Come on, stop, get out of here. And then sometimes you're so peaceful and so wonderful. You're just enjoying the peace and then, okay, meditation over. I said, oh, it's unfair, I'm getting peaceful, why does it have to go? So sometimes the controller, your will, you think that's the problem. So what you do, you want to find the bus driver's seat in your body and mind. Who's in control of you? So, it's very difficult to get out of your seat and go to where the bus driver sits in the front of the bus. It takes a long while to find that part of your mind. The body, you have to let go of the body first of all and find the mind, and in the middle of the mind, your will. Find out who is this being, this thing inside, which is so stupid that it always messes up my peace and happiness. And this is what the job of meditation is. You go deep inside your lotus, where you find where the will resides. You get to your bus driver's seat. You know what you find? You know what you see in there? The bus driver's seat is empty. It's a driverless bus. Google was right. There's no driver in there. Now that shocks you. Sometimes you think, my goodness, well, who's been driving this bus? It's cause and effect, that's all. So what do you do as a result of seeing non-self? There's no one in charge inside. Woohoo. You go back to your seat. You know what happens? You stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. It's like just shouting at nothing, crying in the air. So, that's the simile of the driverless bus. So, we get back to the word of Ajahn Chah. I haven't told this simile yet, but it's a famous one. One of those personal pieces of advice, a teaching from one master to the disciple. And okay, I just went, is the right time to tell the joke? Oh, come on, yeah. Here's one. So somebody once sent this to me. It was a series of cartoons of the master's instructions to his disciple. And the disciple said, I'm just going to go off and stay by myself. Can you give me some advice before I leave, you know, the monastery, and I can actually survive in the world? And the master said to the student, never argue with an idiot. And the disciple said, you know, that's not compassionate, that's not right. And the master thought and said, yeah, I agree with you. It's a bit mean and nasty. What do you think about that? Do you agree with it? But anyway, so this is what happens when you meditate, why you meditate, and just some of the results of it, and how you can get some really good meditation, because this was the last year I was in Thailand, and Ajahn Chah, he was, you know, getting sick, but still really sort of powerful figure. And we decided it was compassion, but it was selfishness at the same time, when we built a sauna in Wat Nana Chat for Ajahn Chah. And I was very heavily involved in that because, you know, I learned a little bit of building. And that we realized that this could be done, because as we saw it when I started studying the Vinaya in Pali, they used to have saunas in the time of the Buddha. And so that's another thing. Saunas were not invented in Sweden. They were in India a long time before they built them in Sweden. So anyway, so we thought, who knows, that might sort of help our teacher's good health. So we built a sauna, but it wasn't, to be honest, it wasn't just an act of selfless compassion for our teacher, because we knew if we had a sauna and he liked it, he would come every week for his sauna, which meant we would see him, we get a teaching every week. And it worked out perfectly. So Ajahn Chah would come every week, you know, to have a sauna. It was the only sauna in that part of the world. He'd come there every week to get his sauna, and he would give us a talk before he had his sauna. So we just always looked forward. Every week we had the teacher give a Dhamma talk, and then he'd go to the sauna, and then he would go back. Perfect plan. And then what happened one day, sort of, you know, well, one day when he came, Ajahn Chah sometimes just gave rubbish talks. And I say that as, you know, as his disciple, you know, revering him immensely. Sometimes he just wasn't, you know, just on song. He wasn't tuned up, whatever it was. Everyone's performance, whether it's in cricket or whether it's in music, sometimes you're really on the job and it just comes out so beautifully. And this particular time, Ajahn Chah was really just beautiful Dhamma talk. And it was in Thai, I could understand it in Thai. And I was just so inspired. There is times when you listen to a talk and whoever's teaching it, oh, that's just, it's almost like the Buddha is talking to you. And you get so inspired and so high. And after the talk was finished, it was usually the job to go and help your teacher, you know, a little task in the sauna, you know, hand him his towel, just rub his back, whatever it was, you know, to do some sort of service for him. But there's other monks going to do that service that day. And I was just so blissed out and so beautiful talk, so happy. I just went round to the back of the hall where no one was, sat down and closed my eyes and meditated. So easy to meditate when you're inspired. And that's one of the reasons why, that when you start meditating, you think of all the beautiful things you've done and all the wonderful things which have happened. And then you get just so blissed out. Then you meditate and, whoa, you're already sort of way into deep meditation. So that's what I did. And just listening to all the, you know, remembering all the amazing stuff what Ajahn Chah just taught. And I was just blissed out and just in really good meditation. And 2 hours went past like nothing. And when I came out of my meditation, just so joyful, you think, wow, I thought of my teacher. So I wonder if there's still something I could do. Maybe I could just, you know, do some little service for him. So I got up and walked towards the sauna. And I realized I was late, because I saw him come in the opposite direction. He was already finished his sauna, robed up and coming with his Thai driver, who was going to take him back to Wat Bopong, which is about 6 kilometers from Wat Nanachar, not that far. And I realized, you know, that we were going to cross paths. And before we crossed paths, he stopped and looked at me. I'd just come out of a really deep meditation. And this is, we talked a little bit about psychic powers before. And, you know, Ajahn Chah, he had these. And I don't mind talking about it now, because, you know, he's passed away. But, you know, it was a strange experience, but the only way I can explain it is you could feel him just reading my mind, like going inside and just having a look around. Most times I would close the doors and run away because my mind wasn't ready to be read. But for once, I was actually quite happy. You know, come inside, teacher. For once, I'm very proud. You can come and read my mind. Just like when you've got a nice clean house, all nice and tidy, then you don't mind sort of your friends coming and have a look. But most of the time, your bedrooms and kitchen is a mess, and you'd rather they didn't see it. And that was most of the time. My mind was a mess. So, you know, please don't come and have a look. And any of you who are afraid of monks reading your mind, if you can do things like that, you only read one or two people's minds, and that's enough. Never again. It's like reading a trash novel. Honestly, you know, be honest. Is your mind ready to be read? No. And poor old monks, they would never do that. Oh, crikey, this is terrible. And they've been meditating with me all these years. But anyway, so you don't read people's minds. That's an invasion of privacy, and it's also too much suffering for the one who reads the minds. So anyway, but for once I was happy. Come inside, Ajahn Chah, have a look around. Yeah. So you could feel him just like someone foraging inside. And then you felt him leave your mind. Now, how can you explain that? What exactly those feelings are, but that's how I perceived them. And then afterwards he looked at me really seriously. And that's when he said, Brahma Wangsa. Just, you know, with kindness, but with power. And you couldn't really move away from him. He said, Brahma Wangsa, why? And that was, you know, in Thai, Tamai, why? It was the question why, a deep question about the nature of reality and everything, why? And I looked at him and I replied, I don't know. And I reverted to my stupidity. A quiet mind, yeah, peaceful, degrees from Cambridge, but, you know, nothing else. And that's when Ajahn Chah, he would never scold you when you were stupid. He would just laugh. And sometimes I wonder, why did Ajahn Chah tolerate so many Western monks? And it was because we gave him so much laughter and humour with our stupidity. Oh, we entertained him no end. So with all our mistakes, so you know, he was laughing at me, you know, just because I didn't know. And then he got serious again and he looked at me and said, Brahma Wangsa, I will tell you the answer. Oh, and that was just really interesting. I lost all my embarrassment about being foolish. And I was he was going to tell me personally, just one-on-one, master to disciple, just no one else was around except this Thai man. He was going to tell me the answer from a great monk, the answer to the question why. And he looked at me again, eye contact, held me in his mind. And the answer to the question why is, are you interested? Yeah, I think you are. The answer to the question why is, there's nothing. There's nothing. My, me, or I. And then he looked at me, and he was really kind, compassionate. He said, do you understand, Brahma Wangsa? Do you understand? And I said, yes. And he said, no, you don't. Oh, that was just, you're really high, getting a personal teaching from a great monk at the deepest level. And then you felt just like a little worm on the ground. No, you don't. And then he walked away. But I always remember that. Just emptiness. Nothing there. In your will, your consciousness, your soul. What's there? There's nothing. There's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. But that was a wonderful teaching about when people start talking about non-self. So anyway, let's go back to what the Buddha said. Oops, you've lost your place. Get out of here. Oh my goodness. I certainly don't understand how to use these machines. What really is amazing, though, that I could go and give a keynote address on world computer conferences. How I get away with that, I don't know. Anyway, here we go. Okay, two exceeds moved off and going up a bit. Okay. So, where are we going? My stomach mush is nice and interesting here. Okay. Here we go. Just underneath. When you've got views and discussions about the soul. You got that? That's just afterwards where the fire simile. You got that one? Okay. Yeah. Okay, anyway. Okay, that's good. Ah, yes, good. So, now we have, like in the Buddhist ideas, the idea of the five skandhas, the five components of existence. Now, many of you who have been to retreats before would have heard them as, was it body, or like form, sometimes they call it, like body, feeling, perception, what's the next one? Sankhara, volitional formations, and consciousness. But if you look more carefully, I always like to put new translations in, because those are old translations, hundreds of years old, no, over 100 years old. So body, okay, but Vedana, instead of feeling, experience is a far more accurate. The experience you're experiencing now, this you experience through any of the senses, this is called experience. The quality of the experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between, that's something different. But this is experience by itself. And then this third classification is perception. How you perceive that experience. And I've always already informed you about how perception can be so uncertain. Sometimes you perceive the beautiful sun. Isn't it a wonderful day today? Nice and warm. But then people who are farmers say, we need the rain. So some people say, we want sun. Other people say, we want rain. And so all of these people, they disagree because they've got different perceptions. Is sunshine good? Or is clouds good? We have different perceptions of what we like. And where do those perceptions come from? A lot of those perceptions, they come from just culture. I was always fascinated that when I was a young man, pretty girls, my girlfriends, had to be thin. And I looked at the poor ladies who were fat, they never sort of got many boyfriends. And I thought, it's just a shame, they're just born at the wrong time. Because if you look at 100 years ago, look at all those paintings which you see in the galleries. All those women were fat. And I think buxom, they were called them, buxom blondes, which means they were, pretty chubby. And that was attractive in those days. So it's sometimes, what is beauty and what is, not beautiful? And it just depends on the culture, what the culture wants to say about you. And so I see that with any of the girls that were a bit too much weighty. In those days, if you were fat, it means you were healthy. And if you were thin, it means, you were about to die. Or, you were really sickly. So that was one of the reasons why that sort of, perceptions of what's beautiful and what is ugly. Sorry. But, so perceptions are just unreliable. They're just made a lot of the time of our culture. And what else we got here? Oh yeah, the perception and the will for that third of the makes up this thing we call a body and mind. And the last one, not the consciousness, but the consciousnesses. Six totally different types of consciousness. And when one is there, the others are gone. And people always think that mind consciousness is the main one, but when you're actually feeling, the mind consciousness disappears for a while. How do you know that? It is because one of the purposes of the deep meditations is to isolate consciousness, mind consciousness, to see it in its pure form when it hasn't got any sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch consciousness, just pure mind consciousness. Such in the same way, and this is the Buddha simile, like a goldsmith, you've got to refine gold first of all. And when you've got pure gold with no impurities, then a chemist can understand its properties. But if it's got a little bit of tin or a little bit of lead in it, when it's not pure gold, then you may not know exactly the real properties of the element called gold. In the same way, said the Buddha, when you can refine this thing we call mind, so you just see the mind and nothing else, no sight, no hearing, no smell, taste and touch, pure mind, then you know what the mind actually is. And when you know what the mind actually is, then you can see it is independent. And when one of these other senses rises, the mind is not there. It comes and goes. So, where has it gone? We go down here. We're a bit further. Yeah, get out of it. Oops. Oops again. Oh, I don't know. Oops. 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 Oh, okay. Now she's testing you. This is, if you can get just above wise contemplations, I'm going backwards and forwards on this. Page 26 in my version, the bottom of page 26 in my version, wise contemplations. You got that one? And it's just above wise contemplation. It would be better for the uninstructed worldling to take this soul as this body, rather than the mind. Why? Because the body lasts for up to 100 years or even longer. But that thing we call mind or mentality or consciousness. You haven't got that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, just above wise contemplation.
Just above.
Yeah. 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 Because this body lasts for up to 100 years or even longer. But that thing that is called the mind or mentality or consciousness arises as one thing and ceases another all the time. It comes and it goes. So anyway, so when you see these things, the stream winner, so you go down to stream winner, because that's what people wanted me to talk about, at least one person did. So, the Sotapanna or stream winner. When you contemplate in this way, three fetters are abandoned in you. A view of a permanent essence, a soul. Skeptical doubt and belief that rites and rituals are sufficient in themselves to reach enlightenment. Those who abandon these three fetters are all stream enterers. No longer subject to rebirth in a lower realm and headed for full enlightenment. Absolute rule over the earth, going to heaven, supreme sovereignty over all worlds, the fruit of stream winning surpasses them all. You getting this? You got this?
Yeah,
good. There are two conditions for the arising of right view. The words of another one who knows what they're talking about. They call him Avi, an enlightened person. And work of the mind that goes back to the source. And there are five factors that build on right view and take it to full enlightenment. So once you've got that right view, the virtue, your learning, discussion, samatha and vipassana, stillness and insight. Okay, let's go a bit further down. The stream winning and the seven in the water simile. Now this is one of the easiest ways to understand what stream winning is and what enlightenment is. There are these seven kinds of persons similar to those in the water. And so I call these like the shipwrecked sailors. Even though the Buddha never says about a shipwrecked sailor, imagine there's a sailor and the ship goes down and they're in the water. There is the first one who goes under and drowns, meaning one with bad qualities. One who floats, then drowns, meaning good at first, but then bad qualities dominate. Number three, one who floats and keeps their head above water, meaning the good qualities become even stronger in their world. And four, the above, they're floating, keeping their head above water, and they look around and they see safety, meaning the stream enterer. You see the safety from all the suffering of life. And the above, they see safety and they start swimming towards safety, no matter how far it is, meaning the once returner. And the above who feel solid earth underfoot, they just swam so fast, they're close to dry land, and they can just stand in this solid land, they can just wade through the surf. And lastly, the above, who is safe on dry land, meaning the enlightened one, free from suffering. Now what happens is that people, they know that these are the teachings of a Buddha, to actually be free from suffering once and for all. And the first one is the stream enterer. Once you are a stream enterer, you see what's happening, you see your delusion, you know exactly what to do. And then it's going to happen. Seven lifetimes at most. And then you're out of here. Now, that is so well known in traditional Buddhist countries that people are just really keen to become stream winners. So much so that there was a retreat center in Colombo, in Sri Lanka. It was a retreat center like this, but with many differences. And one of the differences was it wasn't just meditation, it was also study, formal study, where, you know, it's like being in school, and you were asked questions afterwards and given assignments. And it was like 2 months usually the course lasted. And there was this old lady from the countryside, the mountains in Sri Lanka, central Sri Lanka, and she came to visit her children in Colombo. And the children are really busy, there were doctors and business people, and they thought, well, this is our mother, our auntie, what can we do to give her a gift? And they knew that she used to go to the temple over in the, you know, the local village to give food to the monks and to listen to the sermons. So they thought, well, why don't we sponsor her for one of these retreats? And then when we sponsor her for the retreat, you know, she's, well, you know, she's also out of her hair for 2 months. No, they're being honest. And so, but you know, they loved her. And said, do you want to go on one of these retreats? We'll sponsor you. She said, oh yeah, I'd love to. So off she went on one of those retreats, 2 months. And she did really well, good meditation. And even though they thought she was, you know, a simple woman from the mountains, she understood the Dhamma. She'd almost like grown up with these teachings. And so when they gave her the final test, and the teachers there met together to assess her progress, they all decided that she was a stream winner. And so they called her up And they said, "Auntie, we just looked at your progress and we're all in agreement. Auntie, congratulations. You're on the path to enlightenment. You are a stream winner." And in Sri Lanka, they call it a sowan. Oh, and when someone's a sowan, a stream winner in Sri Lanka, oh, it's a source of great joy and happiness. But not for this lady. She got very angry. She was really upset. She was really shouting at these assessors, these teachers. And the teachers said, "Why? It's a great achievement to be a stream winner. Why are you so upset at us?" And she looked at them, as only old aunties and grandmas can, and said to them, "You don't remember me, do you?" And they thought, "No. Have you been here before?" "Yeah, I was here a few years ago. And last time I was here, you said I was a non-returner. You've demoted me." It's like you've got a PhD, and then they come and say, "No, we'll give you a BA." And so you can't assess these things like that. These are not attainments. Being a stream winner is losing things, not gaining them. Your sense of self is disappearing. You're becoming more selfless, not more of a self, which is one of the reasons why, if ever you go into a good monastery, where that just like here you have buffet service, there's always two lines. In a good monastery, one line is for those who aren't enlightened yet. That's self-service. And the other line is no self-service. It's really nice now that we have, you know, because Buddhism is becoming popular in the West, we have really good Buddhist jokes. Well, I tried to tell one the other day, but he didn't really get it. Because you know how it's really important to be peaceful and still? And there's, you know, all that thinking stuff, you know, that we train ourselves to, you know, to have less thoughts. And so that the abbot was actually commending one of his junior monks, saying, "You are the most thoughtless monk in this whole monastery." Well done. So, and the last little joke before we stop and do a little guided meditation was the person who, you know, in order to get these states of, because you have to do less. Where there's a doer, there's a beer. Not beer, that's the wrong word. There's a being. So that in order for that being to be seen for what it is, you do less and less and less and less. You're still. And there was this gentleman who rang up, called the monastery one day and said, "I really need a monk to come and do a service, to do some blessing ceremony at my house. Can you come?" And the monk replied, "I'm sorry, I can't come today. I'm busy." And the caller said, "Well, what are you doing?" And the monk replied, "I'm doing nothing. That's what a monk should be doing. I'm practicing and I'm doing nothing." And the caller was wise enough, been to many of my retreats, so he knew, "Oh yeah, very good, that's what you're supposed to be doing. All these monks running around like chickens with their heads off, doing this and building that and all this, and like business monks. Just a good monk, you're doing nothing. Well done." So he hung up. And the next day, he called again, and he got through to the same monk. He said, "Oh, you again? Yes, great. Look, I really need you to come to my house to do a blessing." The monk said, "I'm sorry, I can't come today, I'm busy." "So what are you doing today?" "Same as yesterday, I'm doing nothing." But, that's the excuse you used it yesterday." He said, "Yes, well, I'm not finished yet." He I love that little joke. So get nothing out of the way, first of all. When you get nothing out of the way first, don't try that with your wife or your husband, because they've heard me say that before. Yeah, I know that. You've been listening to that Ajahn Brahm again. You come and do the washing up. So anyway, a nice bit of humour, but also a bit of seriousness now. And I slipped all that quite deep Dhamma in there, just between the jokes and the funny stories. Because that's how your will gets conditioned. It's amazing. Do you think your will belongs to you? For the last 6 days or whatever, and for those who've been listening to my talks on YouTube, you have been brainwashed. And I've got no sort of hesitation in saying you've been brainwashed. But it's brainwashed in a good way. It's better to be brainwashed like this than brainwashed by watching the TV or even just watching Bloomberg News or other stuff which just tells you how important it is to keep the economy going. You've been brainwashed to see things in a different way, to be freed. So that's why your will, depends on who you hang out with. Or if you actually hang out with nature, which is brilliant, you can see how nature works and how wonderful it is and what a great teacher it can be. Changes your will, how you see things. And you know it's good because it goes in a good way. Okay, so let's do a little bit of guided meditation. So, how long can we go for today? Is 20 minutes, half an hour? Going over time a bit, but I don't mind that. Are you okay with that? Yes. 25 minutes, half an hour? Yes. Okay, good. Those of you who just need to go to the toilet, just remember, just go to the toilet. It's just another way of letting go. And you know, even if you go to the toilet, I mean, there's a lot of Dhamma in that. Now think about it, if you go and do the number two, you know, the defecating, you've got to relax to the max. If you force it, you know, you get hemorrhoids. And it's true. So just the same, if you force your meditation, you get stuck and you get sick. Relax. Let go. And you find out things come out naturally with no damage or no bad effects afterwards. So, and it wasn't just a sort of a coarse joke, no toilet humour. There was a lot of that. Whatever you do in life, if you relax more, things go far more smoothly and less problems. Oops. There we go. So just to build on something which I said with that experience with Ajahn Chah, there's nothing. Where did that story even originate from? It was when my teacher was saying such beautiful things and I got so inspired. I started off with developing joy and happiness even before I started just even contemplating meditating. So now, as you close your eyes, yes, I mean, please get your body comfortable first of all. Yeah, relax your legs. Make sure your bottom is comfortable. I'll try to speak more loudly, but you know, when you're meditating, everything slows down and calms down. Very well, I'll try. Get your back comfortable. We're looking for a posture which we can maintain comfortably for the next 20-25 minutes. and loosen the shoulders. You ask your hands, are they comfortable down there? Again, it's treating your body like a friend. You care about it. You don't control it and say, this is where you're going to sit. You sit and don't bother me, shut up. You don't use that type of force. You inquire, now how is your head now? Is it well balanced on top of your neck? Do you want to scratch? How are the muscles around the eyes and the mouth? Are they comfortable? As a whole of your body, how does it feel? You're settling in to a good position before you start the meditation. Or I hesitated there because this is the meditation. The preparation is part of it. So I'm looking after my body, feeling it. I'm stretching it now because that feels really good. And when I've finished all the adjustments, I look at the body, one whole unit, grateful that it's pretty healthy. And if there is any aches and pains there, it could be worse. And I care for your body. This is the best I can do for now. So I let you be. And now, I start to think of the most inspiring moments of my life, or even of this retreat. Sometimes I think of great acts of kindness and generosity which I've been privileged to witness. Great visions of beauty, like just listening to the birds, which I can just listen to. And how wonderful it is that I'm free. I can listen to them. And no one is telling me to do something else. Remember the times when I was just sitting out, watching the trees grow, seeing the sunset, or even this morning, the first part of the day, the dawn. To me, that's always magic. It's fresh. I've had a sleep, energized. The air is cool and clear. Imagine the beauty of this moment and the wonderful things you must have done to deserve this moment, to be here. And you start to contemplate your goodness, not your faults, your kindness. And don't be negative and think, no, I have got no kindness or goodness. You have heaps of kindness, huge amounts of goodness. What's the biggest act of sacrifice you've ever done in your life? Something you're really proud of, in the sense you think, wow, did I do that? Did I give so much? And I'm not talking about money. Did I forgive and was kind and spent time with someone who really needed my company and help? What's the best act of kindness and selflessness you've done so far in your life? And linger on it. That was you. You rose to the occasion and went further than you probably ever expected you were capable of. You gave of yourself. gave your time, granted forgiveness. You really did open the door of your heart to that moment, to that person. Maybe you forgot about it. Remember it. And it shows you just how much beauty there is in there, hidden away like a jewel in a safe. And now you're taking it out. You did that. And you start to feel joy and happiness. And then you may remember the time that happened. The time you felt afterwards so happy, so content. You recall the happiest moment in your life so far. I don't mean, you know, winning a lot of money or that type of happiness. I mean the spiritual happiness of peace. When where you were, you didn't want to be anywhere else in the whole world except that one place. With that person or many people, it doesn't matter how many. And if you had a wish, you'd like to be somewhere else with some other people. You say, no, this was such a beautiful time, a time of freedom, of peace, of inner happiness, because you didn't want anything else. You were complete and full in that moment. It may not have lasted, but where was it? Who were you with? Fill in the details of the happiest spiritual moment of your life so far. How old were you? What time of the year was it? Was it summertime, winter, fall? Why was it peaceful? Were you in a room, in a mountain, by a lake? Where were you? And how did it feel? The most peaceful, free experience you've had so far. Was it warm or cold? Were you sitting down, or lying down, or on a chair on the ground, or walking? The reason I ask these questions, because they fill in the details. And the more you recall the most peaceful, wonderful experience of your life so far, the more that peace and that joy strengthen in you. It's like it echoes from the distant past. You can feel the peace and the contentment where you're just happy to be there. You remember that happiness. A happiness which didn't depend upon anything. You were just so contented, at peace, at ease. And as you keep focusing, remembering, staying with that experience, you find you bring from that time a long time ago into this moment so much of that peace and that happiness and that contentment, that stillness. It's like it's back again. Right now, you feel the body just be free and open. Because when it's something negative, you always tend to close up and shrink and be small. You remember the most peaceful, wonderful, contented moment of your life. It's like your body and your mind opens and expands. It has no fear. And then as you remember the most beautiful experience of your life so far, you feel the joy. It's still there. At least a lot of it is still there. And you notice when you focus on that joy, a purity of happiness. You discover your mind is peaceful again. And your mind does not want to wander anywhere. It's enjoying the happiness of being here. Like you had so many years ago. And you recall this beautiful experience. Its echoes are still there. The scent of peace is still there. And as you remain, half in that memory and half right here, you find peace and joy and inspiration are staying with you. And as you relax and let go, you find that peace remains. And maybe you can watch your breath as you did such a long time ago, watching the breath come in, content, easily satisfied. You breathe in the forest, to the sound of the birds, to the comfort of a warm, safe, pleasant room. In this moment, what more do you want? In this moment, be content. This is good enough for me. As you abandon, let go of wanting. Not wanting to improve or get things better. Being content. You find peace comes into your body and into your mind. Happy to be here. And you realize that this moment will never come again. New ones will follow. But now you deserve to be peaceful. When you want something more, you can't enjoy this moment. So you're just happy to be here. Just watching your breath come in and your breath go out. In a moment, I'll be quiet. But if during the following moments you need a top-up of happiness and energy, just recall how good you are. Inspiration of your life so far. The beautiful moments. When you remember them, they re-energize you. I will now be quiet for about 10 minutes or 7 minutes.
just being peaceful, happy to be here. Perfection, happiness, is not wanting anything else in the whole world. In this moment, I remember seeing people in poor villages, so happy, just playing with nothing. All that you want is here. This is called letting be. Happy to be here. Now I invite you to open your eyes to end the little guided meditation this afternoon, if you want to. Very good. Sadhu. 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 Hee hee hee. Excellent.